The remote hearing of the Capital Investment Committee for February 4th is called to order. This remote hearing is taking place in accordance to House Rule 10.01 and is being live streamed by the House Public Information Office. Mr. Lencheski, please take the roll.
Members, you may unmute yourself when your name is called. Representative Fooley.
Lee, present.
Representative Fooley, present. Representative Mary Murphy.
Murphy, present.
Representative Mary Murphy, present. Representative Dean Erdahl.
Erdahl, present.
Representative Dean Erdahl, present. Representative Esther Abadje.
Abadje, present.
Representative Esther Abadje, present. Representative Kayla Berg.
Representative Berg, present.
Representative Kayla Berg, present. Representative Greg Davids. Representative Greg Davids. Representative Keith Franke.
Franke, present.
Representative Keith Franke, present. Representative Mike Freiberg.
Present.
Representative Mike Freiberg, present. Representative Rick Hansen.
Rick Hansen, present.
Representative Rick Hansen, present. Representative John Hewitt.
Hewitt, present.
Representative John Hewitt, present. Representative Leon Lilly.
Lilly, present.
Representative Leon Lilly, present. Representative Eric Lucero.
No sliding into the ditch this morning.
Representative Lucero, present. Representative Rena Moran.
Present.
Representative Rena Moran, present. Representative Nels Pearson.
Pearson, present.
Representative Nels Pearson, present. Representative Donald Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Donald Raleigh, present. Representative Jordan Rasmussen.
Present.
Representative Jordan Rasmussen, present. Representative Liz Ryer.
Ryer, present.
Representative Liz Ryer, present. Representative Nolan West.
Here.
Representative Nolan West, present. Representative Jay Zhang.
Here.
Representative Jay Zhang, present. Representative Greg Davids.
Davids, present.
Representative Greg Davids, present. Members, with the conclusion of the roll call, please mute your devices. A quorum is present.
Thank you, members. A quorum is present. Representative Murphy, can I get a motion to approve the minutes for February 2nd?
I move that we approve the minutes for February 2nd.
So, Representative Murphy, move approval of the minutes for February 2nd. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for February 2nd are approved. Members, today's hearing will cover the sustainable building guideline used by the Minnesota Department of Administration and the state at large because of the buildings benchmark and beyond the B3 program. The Minnesota Department of Administration has worked with the Department of Commerce at the University of Minnesota Center for Sustainable Building Research to develop and support the B3 program. B3 is like other energy efficient building standards, but has been tailored to the specific needs of Minnesota buildings. Today, Director Graves will discuss the role of the Center for Sustainable Building Research, and Director Hunt from the Department of Administration will discuss making state enterprise more sustainable, as well as the governor's proposal for carbon reduction goals for state buildings. At 9:30, we'll then move on to public testimony related to equity or the climate and energy hearings held over the last 2 weeks. With that, Mr. Graves, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, I'm Director Richard Graves, the Director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota. And is it okay if I share my screen?
Please proceed, yep. Here we go ahead.
So I'm going to give a brief overview of sort of the history of the B3 guidelines in Minnesota and progress with the projects over the history of the program. So the B3 guidelines actually began as the Hennepin County Sustainable Building Guidelines developed by Hennepin County in 1995. The state legislature, and I'll go through the statutes in a minute, asked for sustainable building guidelines for state bounded projects, and B3 was released in 2004 for all new state bonded projects. In addition, the legislature required benchmarking of existing state facilities. And so the B3 benchmarking guidelines and benchmarking system also went live in 2004 to track building energy usage in Minnesota. In 2008, the guidelines were updated to include all substantial renovations, not just new projects. And then also in 2008 and 9, the energy portion of the B3 guidelines was replaced with the program called Sustainable Buildings 2030, which I'll tell you more about in a minute. The purpose of the program was to make the guidelines performance-based so each project team could determine the most cost-effective method of obtaining the objective. They were designed to be connected to real outcomes, so to get real energy usage, real benefits to occupants and building owners for projects in Minnesota. The guidelines were also to reflect environmental issues of Minnesota and attempt to address these issues in the following areas: energy reduction, water reduction and pollution reduction, indoor air quality, project management and commissioning, and also site and water guidelines. The Sustainable Buildings 2030 program, the energy portion of B3, was passed in 2008 as part of the Next Generation Energy Act. And it was established to create cost-effective energy performance standards to reduce both energy usage and carbon dioxide emissions, which is important to keep in mind. There are many energy efficiency programs around the country and around the world, but SB 2030 is unique in requiring both energy and carbon reductions in the program. And these programs, these standards have become the energy use requirements for state-bonded projects within the B3 guidelines. also in, let's see here, sorry about that. So legislation 2004, 2009, and 2010, the statutes basically creating the B3 program have received updates over time, and to not only require new projects, but also all major renovations as of February 1st, 2009 to comply with SB 2030 and the B3 guidelines. And also within statute, the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota is designated as the entity to work with the Departments of Administration and Commerce to update the guidelines, maintain them, work with project teams, and bring on other team members to maintain and manage the program. Oops, sorry about that. So it's also important to understand that over time, as we've created the guidelines and deployed the guidelines, it's become sort of a network of programs to support project teams and owners. So there's the guideline portion, which are the requirements that project teams get. We've had around 420 projects, over the history of the program, go through the B3 guidelines process. It's important to understand that this includes both projects that have used the SB 2030 for their energy requirements, but also some older projects before SB 2030 that have the older requirements. It also includes the SB 2030 energy standard. We have over 100 projects that have submitted their design energy use intensity to us. And of those projects, there's an estimated savings of about 534 million kBTUs. That's an energy unit for those of you energy wonks out there. But that translates into about a savings of $8.3 million per year. And I'm going to have some updated numbers at the end of the presentation. The B3 benchmarking program, there's over 7,500 buildings representing over 300 million square feet in the program. And part of the reason all those buildings were benchmarked in their energy performance was to try to identify buildings that are good candidates for energy efficiency upgrades. And you know, about 18% or 1,500 buildings of benchmarking, of the benchmarking program were identified to be kind of easy candidates for energy efficiency upgrades that represent, you know, almost 2 billion kBTUs and the potential savings of $23 million per year in state operations. So how the program works is project teams put in information in our SB 2030 energy standard tool or calculator. So they put in specific information about their project. It's an office of 200,000 square feet in a specific location, and they get a custom energy target to meet their energy efficiency requirements. This is really important, and we've spent a lot of time developing this, so it's tailored to the Minnesota climate, tailored to specific building energy usage, so you get a custom target for your specific project, which is much better for project teams because it makes the target, you know, tailored to their project, much more achievable, much more real, and for them. So it's better than many of the other energy efficiency standards or programs that you see around the country that give more of a generic target to project teams that sometimes can not relate very well to their specific project. It's also important to keep in mind that the program starts. So if you look, this is a very technical part of the program. So if you, this ZEPI standard or the Zero Energy Performance Index, this standard takes a typical building in 2003 would be a 100 on this standard. A net zero energy building or a building that generates all its own energy with renewable energy would be a zero on this standard. And the SB 2030 program basically ramps down and gets more aggressive over time. So in other words, in 2010, when we started, our projects targeted a 60% better than a 100 or a 40 on the ZEPI scale. In 2015, the standard became 10% more aggressive, so 70% better than a 100 or a 30 on the ZEPI scale. And as of January 1st, 2020, we ramped down again, and the current cohort of projects are targeting 80% better than a 100 or a 20 on the ZEPI scale. And it's also important to keep in mind what the building and the base building energy code in Minnesota has been getting better over time. And so there's this relationship of what's the base energy code and what are we doing in SB 2030? And what's the kind of gap between the code becomes an important thing to keep in mind. The other thing that has developed over time is what we learn in the SB 2030 buildings can help inform the energy code about what are the things required as it becomes more aggressive. And it also has educated project teams on some of the things to think about as an energy code might become more stringent. So from 2009 to 2004, the energy code was basically a ZEPI of 57. Again, we were doing a 40 in the SB 2030 program. We then, 2015 to 2020, SB 2030 moved to a 30 with a 50 for the energy code. And then as of the first of this year up until 2025, we're doing a 20. The next Minnesota Energy Code, we'll see what develops. It seems like it's going to be maybe around a 47 on the ZEPI index. So again, Energy Code keeps getting more aggressive, and we keep getting more aggressive in the program. The other thing, kind of big picture to keep in mind, is you take the building stock from what its average usage was in 2003 to being net zero or carbon neutral in the future, is that we've already gone about half of the way there with energy code improvements. We then have the potential of future prescriptive code improvements. In other words, the way the building code works versus SB 2030 is the building code gives a specific list of things for buildings to do, where SB 2030 gives project teams flexibility to do energy models and try different things and then give us you know, their design and how it complies. So the code has the potential to go out to maybe a ZEPI of 35 or so with continuing to do lists of requirements for project teams. Then there's a future potential if the code switches to performance-based codes that maybe it'll get out to a 25 or so on the ZEPI scale. And then ultimately, projects get to the limit of cost-effective energy efficiency, somewhere in the 28 to 15 on the ZEPI scale. Project teams get to a point where energy efficiency is no longer the most cost-effective means to get to carbon neutrality. It makes more sense to then add solar at some scale or other renewables at some scale to get the rest of the way to carbon neutrality. And that's then, you know, the renewable energy supply all the way to zero. Also keep in mind, SB 2030 stops at a 10 on the ZEPI scale. A couple of hands are raised. I don't know if I should take questions at the end or just keep going.
I'll just keep going. We'll take questions at the end after all the testimonies.
Okay. So the one point to keep in mind, SB 2030 stops at 10 on the ZEPI scale with the belief that the last 10 to get to carbon neutrality happens at the grid scale, not at the building scale. So again, it's a network of programs. We have programs for energy efficient operations to work with building owners to get to continue to get performance in their buildings over time. We also do post-occupancy evaluations with projects to figure out how what's working for projects, what are our building occupants satisfied and comfortable, and what are things that are lessons learned for the program that we can weave into future future requirements or adjustments in the guidelines over time if needed. And the energy efficient operations part of the program is important because, you know, studies have shown that, you know, about 15 to 20% of energy usage can happen because of waste, because of, you know, the operation of the building has drifted from normal operations or optimal operations, and adjustments need to happen. I think I'll just click through some of these things. Projects track their compliance with the program and what we call the B3 guidelines tracking tool. Each of the requirements goes into the electronic form, and we can and the project teams can submit their submissions in the form for review by our team to track compliance. We also when project teams meet with us early and we learn more about their project and find that maybe there are particular guidelines. It could be a small project, or it could be a project that doesn't have some scope in their project that for certain guideline requirements, we can adjust the tracking tool so they only need to track and submit items that actually are part of their project. So key roles in the program, each project defines an agency contact as the representative of the state agency receiving the funding to be in charge of the B3 tracking tool to make sure submissions happen. They also have the ability to meet with us about specific project requirements and request variances if there's, say, a program requirement for the project that's in conflict with a particular B3 requirement, we can work out and give our opinion to the agency contact and the particular department whether they should receive a variance for a specific requirement. There also is a guideline leader as a role within the tracking tool, and this is often given to architecture firms. Who are managing or leading the design team to get compliant, to submit compliance with the various B3 guidelines. And key steps in the entire process are early project setup, to meet with us, to get the project set up, educate the team and the owner about the specific requirements. get design team coordination around the goals and how they relate to the guidelines. And then also work through the design of the project, get the submission, and then transitioning the project into operations, because things like SB 2030 require 10 years of actual energy usage to be tracked in the B3 tracking tool for compliance. And then also you're transitioning from the design team being involved and heavily responsible for a lot of the building operations to the actual owner and operations team. And that's important to transition that as well. We also over time have updated the program with alternative compliance paths for different types of projects, from small buildings, projects under 20,000 square feet. We've had for quite a while a small buildings method for the SB 2030 requirements that give them prescriptive requirements that are easier for smaller project teams with smaller budgets to comply with the requirements. We're also working on a small buildings method for the rest of the B3 guidelines, because we've in meeting with project teams over time, we found that to be important. We've also come up with guidelines for many renovation projects or just partial mechanical system upgrades. So we've come up with requirements for those. We've been working with between Commerce and MPCA to adjust and align the requirements with wastewater treatment facilities. And then we've also, in SB 2030, developed and updated what cost effectiveness means. And basically what that has meant is that we've translated that strategies need to have a payback of, it used to be when we initially did this in 2009, strategies had to have a payback of 15 years or less to be cost effective. We updated that last year, and now it's 12 years or less to be deemed cost effective. So, you know, to receive more information about the program, you can go to the website, b3mn.org, for more information about the guidelines or to see the energy standard tool, et cetera. Oops, sorry. It also, on the website, there's a case studies database of projects that have gone through the program to share their performance, to share what strategies they used to achieve compliance. This helps give a feedback loop to new project teams that are coming into the program so they can learn from projects in the past. Another screenshot from the case studies database. And so, you know, B3 project benefits over time. The guidelines really add value to state-funded construction in the following ways: reduced energy and water usage and costs, increased resilience through energy efficiency and improved site design. I think we'll also see increased resiliency over time as we start to have more projects that add solar to the projects. Increased durability for longer building life and reduced maintenance costs. Reduced waste in construction and operation, which mitigates the impact on landfills. Use of local materials, which creates economic benefits. Use of healthy materials that improves occupant health, and improved lighting and ventilation that also improves occupant health. And then SB 2030 benefits in particular, and these are the most up-to-date numbers, are, you know, 197 building design predicted to save, you know, 1,351 million KBTUs per year. To date, 88% of all projects enrolled in the SB 2030 program have documented designs that meet or exceed their standard. And the buildings designed to the energy standard are predicted to save approximately $22 million per year, assuming an average cost of $16.37 per BTU. And these buildings are designed to anticipate a reduction in carbon emissions of 119,000 tons of CO2 annually. And I think with that, I can take questions, and I'll stop sharing.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. And so right now, we'll move on to Ms. Hunt from the Department of Administration. And then we'll take questions after public testimonies too. Ms. Hunt, please state your name for the record and begin with your presentation.
Thank you so much, Representative Lee. I'm Ann Hunt. I'm the director of the Office of Enterprise Sustainability with the Department of Administration. My colleague is going to be loading up my presentation. I'm very glad to be here and share with you a little bit about the Office of Enterprise Sustainability and the opportunities for state agencies to reduce energy usage and greenhouse gas emissions from existing buildings. In 2017, Governor Mark Dayton formally established the Enterprise Sustainability Effort with an executive order. This effort was then reaffirmed by Governor Tim Walz in 2019. The executive order outlines four key elements. It sets six sustainability-related goals, which we'll talk a little bit about more later. It establishes the Enterprise Sustainability Governance Model. It directs the state agencies to participate in the model and outlines agencies' responsibilities. And it establishes our Office of Enterprise Sustainability to both track and report on the progress towards the sustainability goals, but also provide technical assistance and share best practices for the state agencies. And this applies to the 24 cabinet-level state agencies. These are our goals on the screen. The goals shown here were developed by a group of stakeholders from the lead agencies across the enterprise. When I refer to the enterprise, I'm referring to the 24 cabinet level agencies. So these were dated back to 2016. Each of these goals are ambitious and nuanced, and I could probably spend the rest of our time just talking about them. But you'll see some of them are absolute and some of them are relative. And they are have kind of varying goal end dates. The goal for energy is to reduce energy consumed per square foot by 30% by 2027. There's a goal to reduce water consumption by 15% by 2025. And then with greenhouse gas emissions, our goal is to align with the Next Gen Energy Act and reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 30% by 2025. This is, you know, arguably the most important goal, but we put effort towards all six of these areas because they are interrelated. Briefly, I just wanted to touch on our innovative governance model. This really stands out. This model kind of borrowed from that was used in the private sector. They looked at what other corporations were doing in Minnesota, like Cargill and Ecolab. So our first step is in creating this governance model was to have an intentional effort to kind of map out all the existing sustainability work that was already happening within state government and create a structure that helped support those existing efforts and maximize, you know, action with the kind of our core team at the Office of Enterprise Sustainability. So you can see it starts at the top with the governor direction and the vision from the governor and lieutenant governor. Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan have set a very bold goal, an ambitious goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Then we have a steering team, which is made up of a number of the cabinet commissioners from eight agencies. Then, as I said, there's our team that helps supports. There's three work groups that were developed to, and all the agencies participate in that and communicate and share best practices. Then we have each agency has to identify a sustainability coordinator, and then they help drive the work, the implementation with teams within each agency. This is some technical assistance that our team in the Office of Enterprise Sustainability provides to the agencies. We are taking all the information. So with the, as Dr. Graves said, all of the state buildings are in B3 and are benchmarked. So we have about 3,500 buildings that are over 5,000 square feet. And so we're right now in this reporting season. So we're taking all the information from all the water and energy consumed in those buildings, along with all the fossil fuels that are consumed in more than 17,000 vehicles and pieces of equipment that use fossil fuels. We also continually support the work groups, the sub teams, and the steering team. I think one of the important things that we do is provide technical assistance in contracting and in planning. We've developed a number of master contracts for like purchasing electric vehicle equipment. Retrocommissioning is doing a comprehensive energy analysis. And this helps state agencies kind of reduce the burden for doing their own procurement. We've got a technical scope outlined in really robust contracts, and this really helps them more efficiently implement projects. This master contracts are also available for local units of government. So we have a number of cities and counties that are using these master contracts. And then we also really help support the agencies in their long-term planning and data analysis of, you know, where they're consuming energy or water, and then providing, as I said, best practices. So all of this information, as I said, it's millions of data sets. Next slide. is put forward. This is a screenshot of our sustainabilitymn.gov website. This is a public dashboard that shows how every agency in the overall state is doing towards the progress towards goals. You can view this information by agency or by goal. I don't have time to kind of go through it today, but you can take a look at it. It's really very, very comprehensive. This level of detail is, I have to say, is unmatched by any other state sustainability effort in the United States. And as you can see, the efforts that have helped the state of Minnesota avoid over $45 million of costs since the 2008. So please check out our website when you have some time. I wanted to touch on kind of three specific areas on our enterprise's goals. The first is in the area of energy, and then water, and then greenhouse gases. And again, when I refer to the enterprise, I'm talking about the 24 cabinet level agencies. The enterprise has reduced energy intensity by 9% from our baseline, resulting in a 35% progress towards the 30% energy intensity reduction goal. This is reflected in the radial in the middle. So that's how we're showing that. The OAS is also tracking energy consumption, as I said, over more 3,500 buildings. We saw a drop from the baseline in 2017, but since 2017, we've seen some more severe winters, resulting in an increase in energy use to heat the buildings. But that's shown on the bar graph on the right, so you can see how our progress is going. A significant amount of investment will be needed to further reduce the energy use per square foot in the state agencies. Next. This is a snapshot of the water. The enterprise has reduced water use by almost 4%, resulting in a 24% progress towards the 15% water consumption reduction goal. This reduction comes from kind of three main sources: the Military Affairs, Department of Natural Resources, and efficiency improvements at the Met Council's wastewater treatment facilities. Kind of looking forward, agencies are going to be needing to audit landscaping sprinklers, install low flow fixtures, and the Met Council has some significant improvements designed, again, to reduce water at their wastewater treatment facilities. The enterprise has reduced greenhouse gas emissions from its operations, and again, that's buildings and fleets and operations, including water treatment, wastewater treatment, by 18%, achieving a 61% progress towards the 30% greenhouse gas reduction goal. It's important to note that we didn't include in our GHG emissions the emissions coming associated with the closed landfill program. The long-term reduction comes from three main areas. It's the reduced greenhouse gas emissions from the electricity sector, or the decarbonizing of the electricity sector. It's also the consolidation of square footage in buildings, and it's improved energy efficiency in the buildings. Kind of moving forward, agencies will have to make significant energy efficiency and conservation improvements to their existing buildings. You know, building more energy efficient buildings under the SB 2030 program, as Richard Graveside outlined, will require buildings to be 80% more efficient than the average, building was in 2003. It'll also require incorporating more on-site renewables and then potentially purchasing more renewable energy for programs like Renewable Connect. Fuel switching will also be an important strategy for meeting our future reduction goals. I wanted to give a kind of a case study of what it's going to take to really meet these aggressive goals. This is the next few slides I'm going to show you is how the kind of prolonged and consistent efforts have resulted in significant reductions in energy uses at the Department of Administration at the Capitol Complex. And the Department of Administration's Facility and Management Division maintains and operates the 22 buildings on the Capitol Complex, plus about 32 parking facilities. The energy use on the Capitol Complex has decreased by 19%. That's weather normalized from our baseline year of 2008 to 2019. As people may know, admin leases spaces to the various state agencies. So it's really been in admin's best interest to reduce the ongoing operating expenses in those buildings and be good stewards of the taxpayers' funds. As you can see from these charts, we've had some significant reductions over the 10 years or so. I just wanted to highlight a couple of the new initiatives that have been going on. In 2019, the Department of Administration completed a $6 million investment in the transportation building. So we did a number of kind of short-term payback projects like doing installing LED lights, but we also did some projects that have a longer paybacks like updating the air handlers in those buildings. We've seen in the next slide some pretty significant reductions in electricity from those buildings. The pink, the project started in the kind of the summer of 2019. So there's a pink line there. You can start to see the reductions in energy use starting in kind of September through December of 2019. And then the gray line shows what was happening in 2020. Obviously, we were the building was occupied for the first 3 months, and then during the remainder year, it was largely unoccupied, but the Department of Administration needed to kind of maintain and comply with guidance for air exchanges and ventilation in the building, which did use some electricity. And I don't have all the final numbers for December, so that's why it kind of dropped off funny. Quickly, too, I wanted to share, this is some Capitol Complex LED light replacements that we did in 2020. I wanted to highlight this project quickly that admin applied to the University of Minnesota's Technical Assistance Program. It's called MNTAP. It's available for public entities and also private businesses. And we got an intern, a mechanical engineering intern, that worked with our facilities folks to assess the opportunities for retrofitting fluorescent lighting with LEDs at the Capitol Complex. So these were five projects, including the state office building where you all are officed. We were able to do about over $100,000 of kind of, this is the total cost, both lights, parts, and labor, and have an annual savings for the five projects of about $57,000 a year. And these also took advantage of rebates from Xcel Energy. Kind of going back to 2000, currently the administration has four solar PV installations on the Capitol Complex for about 436 kilowatts. The photo on the left is the first installation at the Capitol Complex at the Minnesota Senate building. This building was built solar ready, and it was an ideal candidate for putting a 133 kilowatt installation by Mortenson Construction and Gephardt Electric. We did three additional installations in 2019. I finished in 2019 at the Transportation, Stassen, and Administration buildings. The photo on the right is on the lower roof of the admin building. These three projects totaled about $700,000 and have an estimated savings of $87,000 annually, or about a simple payback of 8 years. These were projects that were initiated under the Dayton administration. They were not... And we're also excited that this was a union crews from Innovative Power Systems that did the last three installations. But we also used the Haline modules from Mountain Iron, and the racking for the system was from Unirec, produced in Alexandria, Minnesota. So about 2% of the Capitol Complex is coming from solar. I know this is a complicated chart, but again, we have all of about 3,500 buildings are benchmarked in the B3 system. Again, as Richard had said, the B3 benchmark predicts how much energy would be used in a particular building and if it were built to today's energy code. This tool gives us an idea of where to find the greatest potential for reducing energy consumption and associated operating costs. Additional assessments would still be necessary to, scope out a project and do the engineering for implementation. And of course, it's a model, and there's some other considerations that might make achieving some of these results really difficult, like the age of the buildings. But I think what we wanted to discuss is this is kind of the potential for avoided energy use and energy costs is primarily lies in the Department of Corrections and Human Services. That accounts for about 70% of the potential. We have 10 state agencies that own their own facilities. I think collectively, if they were doing their initiatives, this would have the potential to avoid energy usage by about 17%. As I said, our office is here to assist people. We want to help the agencies reduce their operating expenses. This is not unlike, what you would be doing in your home by looking at your annual budget and trying to figure out how are you going to reduce some of your expenses so that you could put more money towards your retirement or the kids' savings for college fund or things. So we really want to help agencies reduce their operating costs so they can use that money to fulfill their missions and better serve Minnesotans. I wanted to touch briefly about last year's bonding cycle. The governor included about $356 million worth of projects that I identified that would help state agencies achieve their sustainability goals. Those included asset preservation funds, funds for new construction of sustainable buildings that would be following the SB 2030, there was also investments in solid waste and organics infrastructure and in electric vehicle charging equipment. We appreciated the House included about 85% of those projects in their bill, but only about 34% of the projects eventually got funded. That did include the $2 million for admin to install electric vehicle charging equipment on state property for the use by the state fleet and for the public, and we appreciate that effort. But as I said, there's going to need to be a sustained investment in these agencies to be able to really make progress towards reducing their energy consumption like the Department of Admin was able to do at the Capitol Complex. As Dr. Hellman and Knuth stated at your joint Capital Investment and Climate and Energy Committee last week, we really need to put a climate change lens on the projects that are supported with the capital investment. For example, in the last bonding cycle, there was a number of projects that Corrections and Human Services had in their asset preservation proposal that, if funded, would have funded building automation systems, variable speed drives, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning units that would reduce their ongoing energy use and utility bills. They're not the splashiest projects, but they would have been the type of projects that can make a big impact on improving the agency's energy efficiency and avoid energy costs. So next, I just wanted to touch on, one tool we proposed that had been in the bonding bill and the House bonding bill last year, but then ultimately wasn't funded, was this idea of having establishing a revolving loan to help assist agencies in achieving their energy efficiency and their water conservation goals. About 31 states already have this kind of revolving loan. I was familiar with it when I worked as the sustainability director for the city of St. Paul. Mayor Chris Coleman at the time established $1 million revolving loan fund, and it made significant progress towards implementing energy efficiency projects at the various state or the city departments. St. Paul Port Authority also has one, and the University of Minnesota has a revolving loan fund for the Minneapolis campus. And I know Representative Freiberg has introduced a bill for this, but this a revolving loan fund would kind of help fund these types of projects, whether it was lighting or digital controls. Retro commissioning, as I said, is doing kind of a really extensive energy assessment in a building. If we had a fund like this, the agencies would utilize it. They would repay the fund with savings that they had from their energy improvements, and it would really help the agencies be more efficient and improve their operational sustainability and their resiliency. And they would be better able to kind of weather bad economic times and maintaining kind of the level of service that Minnesotans are expecting from those agencies. And a couple more slides here. I wanted to show this one here. This is the greenhouse gas emissions from buildings shown from the calendar years 2017 through 19. The majority of the emissions for the enterprise, 73%, is associated with the buildings from purchased electricity energy, which includes electricity, the district energy, heating and cooling. This is used to cool and cooling and operating equipment and appliances and some space heating. And then a smaller amount, 27%, comes from the on-site combustion, primarily used for space heating from natural gas, propane, and a small amount of fuel for the backup generators. So this is an area that we want to do some more extensive modeling in the second half of that's on our work plan for 2021. But we're right now, as said, we're kind of in the throes of doing all the data analysis for the 2020 year. While we don't have specific numbers to apply, we know that there's kind of three key factors that we need, that how effective we are in implementing cost-effective energy efficiency and conservation measures, as I've, you know, kind of discussed before. The decarbonization of the electricity grid will go a long way to reducing our overall greenhouse gas emissions from the buildings. It's been one of the primary drivers to date. And then finally, as I said, on-site combustion fuels, fuel switching will be another way for us to further reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. You know, for example, the Department of Administration has reduced its greenhouse gas emissions from its buildings by 50% through reducing energy use and energy efficiency by almost 25%. We purchased renewable energy tariff called the Renewable Energy Government through Xcel Energy for more than 20% of the remaining electric use. And then we've, as I discussed, we installed some on-site rooftop solar. So with that, that's gives you kind of a highlight of what it would take, I think, for state government to really significantly reduce energy and greenhouse gas emissions. And as I said, I think it'll be important for you. I know there's a lot of variables that you have and factors that you consider when you're putting together the capital investment budget, but having a climate change lens on that will be very important moving forward. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Hunt. And so now we'll move over to public testimonies. And for our public testifiers, we will limit your testimony to 2 minutes so that we can save about 20 minutes for members to ask questions at the end. And so with that, I will begin with Ms. Crystal Porter. Please state your name for the record and begin. Ms. Porter, you're on mute.
I apologize. Hi. My name is Crystal Porter, and I am the executive director of MN Renewable Now. I'm also a resident of North Minneapolis. And I can just
please proceed.
Go right into it?
Yep.
Okay, sorry about that. All right, so when I was a child, cell phones didn't even exist. It was actually considered a privilege to have even a cordless phone in your household. Now, fast forward in just the past 2 decades, we went from phones we can walk around with without a cord to devices that not only serve as phones, but instead as personal assistants that manage our bank accounts, pay our bills, manage our schedules, and is even allowing some of us to meet face to face today. I think it's interesting that technology has changed so dramatically in how we conduct our everyday lives on a global scale. Yet the energy system we depend on so heavily has not seen the same pace of transformation. Renewable energy is increasing, yes, but not fast enough. We have less than a decade to achieve 50% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. The same momentum we use to evolve our technology is the same momentum that we need to source our energy if we are going to reach net zero by 2050. Although energy is our biggest problem now, it is also our biggest solution. With the help of you, our elected leaders, to pave the pathway and to inject resources into the work to make the change of transformation of our energy, together we can secure and sustain a clean and prosperous future for everyone. If our goals are to be 100% renewable by 2050 and zero carbon by 2030, then why are we continuing to allow gas lines and new construction? Why are gray water systems not allowed in the Twin Cities? And why are we allowing large monopolies to limit community solar? If we say that we care about racial equity and environmental justice, then why do we not have inclusive financing to maintain our aging properties to meet our energy efficient needs? Why are we not using every opportunity for renewable energy to power our cities, such as restoration, hydro plant, and our rivers? Instead of compromising our earth and building a pipeline through our bodies of water that in due time will pollute and poison some of our most vulnerable populations, we could be utilizing our fresh water to power what we need right here.
Ms. Porter, if you could wrap up, please.
Yeah. You heard Richard Graves. He said that the last 10 on the ZEPI scale happens at the grid level. If you multiply that last 10 by buildings across the state, and what we have is slow progress. When it comes to climate change, slow progress is the same as no progress. Thank you.
Next up, we have Ms. Pinkella. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Good morning, Chair Lee and committee members. My name is Stephanie Pinkella, and I work for the Nature Conservancy in Minnesota. TNC's mission is to create a world where nature and people thrive by protecting the lands and waters on which all life depends. And climate change is an urgent threat to that work. It threatens human communities through flooding and heat vulnerability. And we see our northern forests declining and iconic plant and animal species shifting northward out of Minnesota. Your joint hearing last week highlighting the intersection of climate and capital investments included several references to nature-based solutions or to natural infrastructure. Science tells us that nature is a critical tool to address climate change. Land-based emissions are the third highest carbon emission source in Minnesota, and one of the areas where the state has made the least progress. A recent report by our TNC scientists that was made available to the committee this morning shows that natural and working lands can sequester nearly 20% of Minnesota's emissions. In our state, the number one land-based tool with the biggest mitigation potential is forests and tree planting, followed by improved carbon storage on agricultural lands. In addition to sequestering carbon, our forests, grasslands, and agricultural landscapes in Minnesota can also keep water clean, provide resiliency benefits, in addition to many economic, health, and wildlife benefits. As this committee considers which infrastructure investments you'll include in a bonding bill that can tackle climate change, there are natural infrastructure projects that can be implemented immediately that will use nature as an effective carbon sequestration and resilience tool. So first is ongoing investment in the DNR Forests for the Future program, which received $1 million in funding in the most recent bonding bill passed by the legislature. And we thank you for including that program. We encourage you to continue to invest in a voluntary program like that, which has a waiting list. But other critical capital investment eligible natural infrastructure programs could include reforestation, increasing the state's tree nursery capacity. We're not even meeting our current capacity. Working grasslands easements, floodplain protection, and land acquisition like aquatic management area and the scientific and natural area acquisition programs. We look forward to being a resource for this committee on behalf of our science and our science team, and hope we can provide more information on those programs and just generally on natural climate solutions. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Pinkella. Sorry for butchering your name. Next, we have Ms. Garrett Johnson.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you. Please proceed.
Okay, great. So my name is Linda Garrett Johnson, and my background is in organizational development, and I'm also a certified Lean Six Sigma business process improvement consultant. But as you can also see, I'm a person of color. So as I talk to you today, it's going to be through my lens of process improvement, as well as my work in authentic community engagement, specifically with underrepresented and underserved communities and the BIPOC community. One of the things that I did as I was asked to give public testimony was I began to look at the bonding process, the application process itself. And I did my own quick assessment. I could do a deeper dive if I had more time. But one of the things that I see is that in order to achieve equity in capital investments, you must address the business model and the processes by which the funds are made available and distributed. What I'm talking about here, just really quickly, is that this includes a review of the bonding application and its process, setting clear equity expectations for project identification, making sure that there are authentic, culturally appropriate engagement of the BIPOC community and unengaged, marginalized communities in project identification and the selection process, particularly at the local unit of government level. And then utilizing an equitable development scorecard for both state agencies and especially for local units of government so that they have something to baseline whether or not the projects that they are selecting are equitable. And then recognizing that most local units of government are not managed or administered by BIPOC leadership. So there most likely is no equity lens in the identification of projects. And then finally, providing technical assistance and guidance to both state agencies and local units of government. We can't expect that people are going to be able to do this on their own, that they're going to understand how to do it. I know a lot of people mean well, but it's going to be difficult. And so finally, what I want to wrap up and say is that I know the conversation's focusing on understanding how BIPOC communities are impacted by capital project decisions. It's not intended to divide. It's actually intended to educate. And in doing so, this can be uncomfortable to hear. As we look at this, think of it as not trying to divide us, but as trying to educate us. Because we also need to understand that, especially like at the local level, I'll wrap up. There's zoning and planning policies in the suburban communities that have unintended consequences that severely impact BIPOC and other marginalized communities as those projects go forward. I'm available as a consultant to help explore this further, especially as we look at having an equity lens in the application and the bonding process. Thank you.
Next up, we have Ms. Erica Slager Dos Santos from the Family of Trees, Mi'kmaq Nation. I apologize if I butcher the name.
No, thank you, Chairman Lee, for having us to testify. I'm Erica Schlager Dos Santos. I'm one of the co-founders of the Family of Trees in North Minneapolis, and also Mi'kmaq Nation with two other folks from our community, Christelle Porter and Yordanosi Solomon. We are in the business of engaging our community to replant the tree. The tree is not our main objective, but the tree sits at the intersection of soil, air, water, and sun. One of the most effective solar panels in our natural world is the tree. And the way that what happens above the soil in the infrastructure world with trees in nature is the capacity to remediate, regenerate, restore, and reconcile our relationship with air, water, and soil. Below the soil, I hear often the Capital Investment Committee speaking about infrastructure and buildings and framework. And I'd just like to draw your attention to the capacity that the role that trees play in the infrastructure and structure of soil. As those roots go down, water remediation is a big part of it. But as those roots go down into the soil, there's this whole microbiological piece that's going on down below the soil. And we would like to regenerate that relationship. More importantly, in our community, we have micro projects happening. And I would encourage the committee to look at how these investments are answering what Dr. Curry spoke to the other day of the requirement of all public contracts supporting 15% of them supporting BIPOC communities. If you turn your attention to North Minneapolis, we have solar installations going on roofs. Thank you. We have solar installations going on roofs, and our objective is to reforest our community to bring that heat index down. So every opportunity that you have to consider soil and also the installation of permeable surfaces in our hyper-localized community, we feel like supporting the work by employing those from our community, they're already doing this work, and micro development possibilities for BIPOC-led organizations in North Minneapolis would be awesome. Thank you so much.
Ms. Gardner, please state your name for the record and please proceed.
Hi, my name is Nancy Gardner and I'm from District 59B. My story takes us right to the intersection of climate change and equity solutions. Thank you for listening. In the fall of 2018, I felt overwhelmed by the world's climate change problems. What can just one person do? My neighbor said, let's start organics recycling in our community. Well, she and I live in an 87-unit townhouse neighborhood on the Mississippi in downtown Minneapolis. So we got to work. We educated ourselves with the help of county and city staff. We researched adding a second waste hauler. We created our own materials, conducted surveys, and hosted Zoom meetings. Door to door, face to face, we answered our neighbors' concerns. And with their support, we challenged our reluctant board of directors to join us. Our work took two tough years. We persevered. The results? Starting last November, 5.4 tons of vegetable scraps, fish bones, and other waste from our neighborhood will be converted into compost this year. That compost nurtures trees, gardens, and plantings throughout Hennepin County. It also helps mitigate climate extremes and creates more green jobs. One neighborhood, that's small scale, right? There's more. I also belong to Mill City Commons, a group of proactive people who live along the Mississippi. I helped Mill City create its own climate change group. We kicked off our campaign with a message of support from Mayor Jacob Frey, and in just 6 months, we've gone from 12 buildings that recycle all the way up to 16. Now in 2020, thanks to my representative, Esther, I've reached out to women of color in North Minneapolis to see how we can expand this work in their community. You can see the how climate change, equity, and community building come together.
Ms. Gardner, please wrap up.
The handout I gave you, and if you approve funding legislation for climate change initiatives like organics recycling, we'll continue our work. If you take the first step, we'll take the next two. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Isabel Chancellor. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Isabel Chancellor, I'm with Midway Rise Up, and I'd like to share with you what's happening, not specifically what's happening, but what we would like to see at the intersection of University, Snelling Avenue, and University, and Lexington. We're dealing with a lot of development that has been spurred because of light rail, which I was part of the light rail project. But at this point in time, we feel like we're being attacked, and it's not just a feeling, it's really happening. And so what we would like to just ask of you is a lot of help. And so in being able to push back on inequitable development or sustainable community development that includes economic development within historically BIPOC neighborhoods. And so we're asking for assistance in trying to figure out like how to make these processes transparent, something that Linda Garrett Johnson talked about. Creating funds that make property acquisition and land banking for community groups much more accessible and affordable, helping us influence policy improvements from zoning into planning into development to match racial equity and combat homelessness goals or helping us to combat homelessness goals, to create financing and funds to spur community developers to do more development projects within BIPOC neighborhoods much like some of the housing finance that's being done, but that's just not a process that's available now in the state of Minnesota. Create incentives that can, you know, that really, really combine with TIF, new tax credits, opportunity zones to encourage developers who do want to develop in BIPOC neighborhoods to do that with more of an equity lens and not so much of a damage. Create standards and requirements for compliance. I heard a lot this morning about compliance that you have set up in your energy work. And that's the kind of compliance and hardline scorecards that we need for racial equity. There are some smart people at the state that put that together. I'm highly impressed. I would really love to see that in all of our BIPOC communities and to be a partner with the state in developing something that really takes Minnesota into a whole nother level. Thank you.
Next up, we have Elizabeth Turner from the American Institute of Architects, Minnesota. Please proceed and state your name for the record.
My name is Elizabeth Turner. I'm AIA from Principal at Precipitate Architecture, which provides consulting and design for passive buildings, including B3 and SB 2030. And I'm here today on behalf of AIA Minnesota's nearly 2,300 architects. AIA Minnesota has placed a top priority on finding ways to address climate change and create environmental justice for all of our citizens. We know that nearly 40% of all carbon emissions come from the construction, heating, lighting, and operation of buildings in our state. Because of the built environment's significant impact on our climate, our architects believe that it is our responsibility to constantly seek new ways to reduce the carbon footprint and energy needs of buildings. As you have heard earlier this morning, SB 2030 has been a powerful and effective tool in accomplishing that mission in public buildings. Bonding is one of the most effective economic development tools in the state's toolbox, and the application of SB 2030 to public construction projects provides further benefits. And the positive impacts go even further as the data from these public projects helps us capitalize on climate action opportunities in the private sector. Rather than just tell our clients high-performance building is possible, we are able to show them and have gone through the process and developed the skill for high-performance design within our firms. If we want to change the tides of our changing climate, it is imperative that all buildings are constructed with a focus on sustainability and resiliency, and this public sector's commitment to reducing carbon emissions in the buildings helps illuminate a path forward towards those broader goals. Critically, bonding is an opportunity to begin to repair the impacts that environmental racism has on our communities where there has been historic disinvestment. High-performance buildings in these communities are healthier and reduce energy burden at the same time as they mitigate future climate impacts. We urge you to continue to support regular, robust bonding bills that support a wide variety of projects around the state. We also encourage you to continue the application of the SB 2030 standard to the broadest possible range of public building projects so that the standard can continue to reduce the climate impact of our built environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Turner. Next up, we have Chris Connery with the 100% campaign. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Chris Connery. I'm with the 100% campaign. Chair Lee and members of the committee, we're a coalition of over 50 organizations advocating for a 100% equitable and clean energy future. I want to applaud the committee for its work over the last 2 weeks. We think it's important to get and stay grounded in both the racial equity and climate challenges that Minnesota faces, but also in the shared opportunities we have to improve communities across the state. Sometimes people think bonding is mostly about buildings. What the last 2 weeks have shown is that bonding is mostly about people. People are going to walk through those doors and bike on those trails and learn in those rooms. Given that, we want to lift up not individual projects, but rather a set of questions for you to ask about all projects. First, how does the project advance racial, gender, and economic equity? The testimony you heard from the University of Minnesota's Center for Small Towns pointed out ways that this question is relevant and doable in every corner of the state. Second, how is a project climate adapted? The Insurance Federation of Minnesota shared a timeline of extreme weather events that we've experienced since 1998. Is every project self-consciously preparing for those impacts that we expect to continue in the future? Third, is a project energy efficient and will it reduce greenhouse gas emissions? This is a win-win-win for Minnesota, lessening pollution, lowering costs, and creating opportunities for family-supporting jobs. this spring, and as you tour projects over the summer and into the 2022 session, you're going to be asked to consider many laudable projects, more than you can accept. And as you evaluate each of those, we know you'll ask lots of questions and learn a lot about our communities. We hope that you'll continue to ask these three questions throughout. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Connery. Next up, we have Commissioner Victoria Reinhardt from Ramsey County. Please proceed, Commissioner.
Chair Lee and committee members, I am Ramsey County Commissioner Victoria Reinhardt, and I am speaking today on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Partnership on Waste and Energy to highlight the importance of state capital assistance investments to achieve environmental, climate, and equity benefits through funding of local solid waste projects. Minnesota counties are committed to reducing, reusing, and diverting waste from landfills through recycling, composting, and processing. Yet 32% of Minnesota's solid waste continues to be dumped into landfills. The MPCA's Solid Waste Capital Assistance Program is the state's main program to assist local governments in financing the infrastructure necessary to minimize land disposal. Since 1985, CAP has provided over $80 million to assist more than 90 projects. The 2020 bonding bill approved funding for six CAP projects that will provide services in more than a dozen counties. One of those projects is the Ramsey Washington Recycling and Energy Center in Newport, which received a $7 million appropriation for improvements to remove more recyclables that remain in the trash and support a new food waste collection system available to all households in the two counties at no charge. Thank you, Chair Lee and members, for this allotment. These improvements have been framed by policy direction to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and pivot from waste to resource. This project will recover over 60,000 tons of material annually and will reduce greenhouse gas emissions equivalent to taking over 2,300 cars off the road. These are sustainable benefits that will keep more waste out of landfills. This is just one example of many of how CAP has been important in helping counties make important investments with a focus on a sustainable, climate-resilient Minnesota. Examples of how future CAP projects can further reduce greenhouse gas emissions include projects to expand capacity to keep organics out of landfills. We encourage you to make investments in projects like these through CAP and even consider increasing the state share to encourage more of these projects. Thank you, Chair Lee and members of the committee.
Thank you, Commissioner. Next up, we have Rob Sipp from the Red River Watershed Management Board. Please proceed.
Thank you, Representative Lee. And yes, my name is Robert Sipp, and I'm the Executive Director of the Red River Watershed Management Board. And so actually the Red Board has been working on climate adaptation and resiliency for almost 50 years. The Red Board was actually formed by the legislature in 1976 to primarily deal with flood issues. And since that time, we've been working on several projects and efforts, not only on the Minnesota side of the basin, but also with some of our other partners on the North Dakota side. So the Red Board has actually helped co-fund 60 projects over the years. And in the fact sheet that is shared with you, there's a map on the back side to illustrate those 60 projects that have been done over the years. We also have 11 additional flood projects in the works right now, and quite a bit of storage has been developed and placed on the landscape. We also have 10 water quality projects that are in the works through our recently adopted water quality program. And then kind of looking back that in 1997, the big flood that we had up there in the Red River Basin really pushed and moved a lot of additional change over the years. And one thing I'd say is that our projects are engineered and designed according to current standards and requirements, but there are definitely difficulties when you start looking at 500 year plus storm events. So from a city perspective, largely most of the cities are protected. We are still doing some work with updating city flood levies on a few of the smaller cities. And in conjunction with that, we're also working on some road raise projects with local road authorities, MnDOT, and also the member watershed districts. Regarding ring dikes, we've helped co-fund just about 300 farmstead ring dikes since 1997. And that's been in conjunction with the state of Minnesota, federal government, watershed districts, and landowners. And we've allocated just about $11 million for that effort. Now we still have quite a bit of work to do left to, reduce ag land flooding and impacts to agricultural areas. So the work is continuing in that front. We've also helped do some flood buyouts over the years in conjunction with our member districts. And then I think zoning continues to be an important tool to prevent construction and floodways. And also regarding drainage, our member watershed districts. Okay, thank you. Our member districts do work on drainage. And with that, there's a few other bullet points on there that I know you can take a look at. But ultimately, we do this work through the flood hazard mitigation program and bonding dollars. And there's a significant need yet that needs to be met with all the funding activity out there. So with that, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sipp. And the members, this is the last public testifier, Marie Ellis from the Racial Equity and Joy.
Good morning, Chair Lee and members of the committee. I am Marie Ellis. I work at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and I'm here today representing the Racial Equity and Joy Coalition. As we've been hearing today, the state's bonding process is not racially equitable in practice. Just one example of that is the 50% non-state match requirement. Deep structural racism in our country and in our state has resulted in less access to high-level donors and philanthropic partners for projects that are specifically in and for communities of color, which means that these projects are less likely to be eligible for state bonding dollars. This committee should discuss the 50% non-state match requirement, as well as when and for which types of project that requirement is waived, as just one example. The Racial Equity and Joy Coalition supports three steps. First, we ask this committee to examine the bonding process through a lens of racial equity. We recommend that both MMB when soliciting requests and this committee when it reviews requests use Voices for Racial Justice's equity impact assessment tool. Second, we ask this committee to include an equity article in every bonding bill, similar to the 2020 bonding bill. And finally, we ask that you support investing in outreach and assistance to support community-based organizations led by people who are Black, Indigenous, and people of color, or BIPOC, who have historically not been engaged in state bonding projects, including from legislators to BIPOC-led organizations in their districts. The goal is that examining the bonding process through a lens of racial equity will lead to reforms in the process, thereby no longer needing an equity article or investment in outreach and assistance to specific communities. On behalf of the coalition, thank you for this opportunity to engage in this conversation.
Thank you, Ms. Ellis. And members, before we move on to questions, I do want to let members of the public know that we will be taking a written testimony 24 hours until after we're done with committee today. And so first up for members' questions, I will have Representative Pearson. Members, we have about 14 minutes left, and so let's try to limit that to 2 minutes each, a minute for questions, remarks, and then answer. Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Chair Lee. I can't help but observe that we seem to have a new mute button, and that's stacking the committee hearings with so much content that we can't actually ask questions. As legislators, we really do need to dig into these issues, and I appreciate all the testifiers that were here today, but I really would encourage chairs from numerous committees to please do a better time management so that we can actually address these issues and dig in a little deeper. My first question is to Director Hunt. Specifically, it's really a kind of probably just a technical question. When you're talking about your, you had a couple of charts that referenced annual energy use, and you referenced steam and chilled water on a couple of examples. I'm actually, we're not using, we're not using geysers or anything like that in Minnesota. So what's the sourcing of those? Is that waste steam that's coming from other facilities? Or what's the source for, chilling the water and steaming the water so that we can better track what the actual energy source is?
Chair Lee, representative, I'm sorry, I had an error on the slide. It should have said hot water. About 80% of the Capitol complex is on the District Energy St. Paul system, where they burn wood waste to heat water, and pipes go up, the street and heat the buildings. This is eliminated. This process has been in place since the 1970s. So that's where it should have been labeled instead of steam, hot water. They also operate a district cooling system that has chilled water, and you can see a big tank kind of down by the river. There's another one kind of on the right off of I-94. So they take water typically when it's kept at a 55 degree temperature, then they chill it a little bit further, and it pipes cold water to the buildings cool the buildings.
Mr. Chair. I think I generally have an understanding of that. If Mr. Yeah. Graves is also available, I guess this is just sort of a general question as well. When we talk about these projects, we add a lot to the costs, and that is one of the things that hasn't been brought up on the discussions this morning at all, is how much this increases the costs. And where I really struggle with this, especially with the lens of energy use and efficiency and reducing the carbon emissions, we have a lot of projects, especially with HEPR and other areas, where we can track and say, because we're adding the costs on this project, we aren't going to be able to get to these other projects for a number of years. And when we focus so heavily on getting to the zero levels and pushing to those zero levels, we continue to drive up the costs on new projects or driving up the improvement costs on the standards, meaning other projects that we can't get to will continue to be inefficient for a number of years. Do we do a cross analysis of, again, there isn't just an infinite pot of money that we're pulling bonding dollars out of. These are taxpayer dollars. At the end of the day, we're borrowing, we're paying interest, there are costs associated with the bond sales. All of this drives up the cost of those projects. And when we can't get to some of the other projects because we've added to the costs of the other ones, do we look at that in a lens of when we've increased and scrutinized and raised these standards so high that the costs reduce the return, especially with the climate ones? Can we address that?
Mr. Graves.
So two things. One is we have built into SB 2030 the cost effectiveness lens. So whatever additional costs need to pay back within 12 years. And what we're going to see, I think, as we get more and more aggressive with SB 2030, we're going to hit that limit with more projects and need to adjust the standards to basically find that balance point that you're talking about between increased costs and making sure it returns. What we've seen so far with the projects up to this point, not the 80% better projects, but the projects 60, 70% better, generally, we do track costs as best as we can. It's very difficult with varying size projects, different project teams, et cetera, but most projects have been in the 1 to 2% additional costs. And then in addition, whenever we make guideline changes, not in the energy section, but in the rest of B3, we work with our team and we do focus groups with agencies, project teams, et cetera, to give us a statement of what we think additional costs could be. And we try to limit those additional costs as much as possible, not only on the capital construction side, but also in the design and consulting side. So.
Thank you, Mr. Grave. And members, we have 6 members left and 8 minutes for questions, so please keep your questions short. Next up, we have Representative Ryer and then Representative Lucero. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair Lee. I want to start by saying, from my point of view, the opportunity to hear so many perspectives, both from experts in the industry as well as community members, is great for the committee, as well as for all of the people who are watching. It's a great learning experience, and I appreciate it. One of the things that struck me today when Mr. Graves was talking was that we have on the network, you identified over 1,500 buildings that would be good candidates for improvement. So I was thinking about it, you've covered the climate lens there, but how does that map over having some equity across the state, making sure that all communities have the opportunity for economic development? And then particularly as a tool for communities that have been underinvested in, particularly BIPOC communities, how can we use those together to prioritize? Because that's what I'm coming down to here, is that as a committee member, we're gonna need to make choices in how we allocate our scarce resource of the bonding pool. Thank you.
For Grace.
So you know, the chart I was showing in terms of B3 benchmarking and opportunity for savings is purely a technical sustainability carbon reduction lens. We haven't been requested by the legislature to do an equity lens or a resilience lens, even though, you know, we've researched and developed standards and guidelines for those types of lenses. It's not something that we're authorized to do.
Representative Lucero. Representative Lucero, we can't hear you.
Okay, how about now? I'll take the speaker. I'll take the headphones out.
Okay, yeah, you're good.
Well, the audio is probably not as good. I apologize. I want to echo by starting, I share the concerns that Representative Pearson brought up. 90-minute committee hearing, we had 76 minutes, which equals 84% of a one-sided, lopsided information. And then we have 14 minutes, which is 16% of the time allocated for member questions. And this is ridiculous. So I can't ask any questions. I'll just make comments. And I'll have to save the balance of my comments and for the House floor, of which I will have many hours to express my concerns. The first would be, Ms. Garrett mentioned something about an authentic culture of the BIPOC community. As a Hispanic myself, I have no idea what that means. What is an authentic culture? I find that actually very concerning language, to be honest, because I consider myself, and I know many, in fact, most who would consider themselves minorities are a member of the melting pot of the American culture, which emphasizes constitutional principles, individual liberty, and equal opportunity. I heard one testifier mention something to the effect of planning in the suburbs having unintended consequences on marginalized communities. I ring back to our I think it was last week when it was asserted that zoning to prohibit chickens in residential neighborhoods is somehow racist. Continuing the dialogue of something that's just utterly ridiculous. I heard numerous comments from numerous testifiers regarding the lens of racial equity, racial, gender, and economic equity. Members, there is a big difference between equity and equality. Equity is just the new term that is being used as a substitute for socialism and redistribution of wealth. The term we should actually be using is equality, which is the basis and the founding of our great country, equal opportunity and equality to pursue our dreams. Not equity, because equity is, again, using government to redistribute wealth through a socialist system. I heard two absolutely ridiculous terms, environmental justice and environmental racism, completely and utterly ridiculous. I don't even know what those things mean. What is environmental racism? And lastly, Mr. Chair, I heard Commissioner Reinhart say a climate resilient Minnesota. I guess the question I would have for her in a rhetorical sense, because there's no time at this point, what is the approximate cost to achieve this so-called climate resilient Minnesota? And would that have made Minnesota resilient to the melting glaciers when the earth warmed up out of the ice age?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of interesting to respond to that, but I think the focus here is that with public investment, so we're the Capital Investment Committee, that there are consequences to that investment. And if we open our eyes, we see those consequences. And for a very long time, we have not seen those consequences. We just do what we want to do, and we base our decisions on who has the power and who can lobby and who can make the case for those investments. And what I think we're hearing is that there are people who do not have that opportunity, who are denied those investments, that are public. They pay into the system. They are part of our community. We're all in this together. But some people don't reap the benefits because they don't get the chance for the infrastructure. The opportunity when we're dealing with climate resiliency is that we all are going to suffer the fate if our climate continues to become result in more erratic weather, more cost that we have to pick up on the public dime. So prevention is cheaper than cleanup. We can make those investments, and it sounds like we already have the leadership happening in state government. We need to enhance it, advance it, and do more of it to help everybody out.
Thank you, Representative Hanson. Representative Erdog, and then Representative Bajay. Representative Erdog?
Okay. Representative Lee, Mr. Chair, just a quick comment here. First, actually, it's a question of you. Equity, climate, we've heard a lot about it lately. I want to know, how do you see this? And maybe this is going on with Representative Lucero's comments. How do you see equity and climate and impact in our bonding bill with the caveat that most of our projects come from government entities? Will they all be required, that our cities and our counties, to address equity and climate concerns in their requests?
Thank you for the question, Representative Erdahl. And for me, I want our community members to take these two in consideration when we evaluate projects. And I will let the members know that when your local projects are coming to meet with me as the chair of the committee, I am asking them about what are they doing to engage with our BIPOC communities and what are their projects doing with regards to environmental impact. And so even if we don't take that into consideration as a committee, that's my commitment to our members and, you know, for folks who are coming to the before the committee. And Representative Bajay, I apologize, we are at a time right now, and so we'll take you up first for the next committee. And so on Tuesday, we'll be hearing from the Commissioner of the Housing Finance Agency to talk about housing infrastructure bond and how do we solve the housing crisis that we have in the state of Minnesota. With that, members, the committee is adjourned.